Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Antioch University, New England, helping students change the world with graduate degrees in environmental studies, psychology, education, and management. antioch.edu/new-england.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. He was called the Hercules of the Pilgrims at Plymouth, a man whose legendary energy, intellect, and diplomatic skills kept the colony from dying out, yet whose name is little known. He's Edward Winslow, a passenger on the Mayflower when it left England in September of 1620. Like his compatriots, Winslow was seeking religious freedom, but it was his friendly, respectful relationships with Native Americans that allowed the colonists to survive. And it's his description of an abundant feast with the Indians that set the table for our modern Thanksgiving. Today in The Exchange, a new book written by British historian Rebecca Fraser focuses on the familiar pilgrim story on Edward Winslow. It's called The Mayflower, The Families, The Voyage, and The Founding of America. You can join us with your questions and comments. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Rebecca Fraser joins us from a studio in New York. And Rebecca, a big welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, how is a British perspective on this story different? We've looked at this story a number of times on this show, but always with American authors. So how is your take different?
Well, I think there are quite a lot of documents in England in the National Archives which aren't really available to American researchers about the beginning of the Mayflower Enterprise, about their seeking permission to leave England. And so there's really an abundance of material which hasn't really been utilised. And although it's time consuming, I think it gave us a fuller picture of Edward Winslow and many of the other pilgrims. So that's where I started.
Well, and it is interesting. And one of the things I appreciate about the book is you do give us a lot of description of all the stuff that happened even before anybody set foot on the Mayflower or the other leaky boat that they ended up not taking.
Yes.
But just before we get into that, Rebecca, just clarify the difference for us, please, between a pilgrim and a Puritan, because these days those terms are used interchangeably.
Okay. The people on the Mayflower were a separatist church who start in Nottinghamshire in England. They move to Leiden in Holland. They call themselves the Pilgrims, and William Bradford, in that great American classic of Plymouth Plantation, calls them Pilgrims. They are Puritans, but they are separate to the Puritans who come and settle Massachusetts. So they are self-named, and then they are known as the Pilgrims, the Pilgrim Fathers. They are not the Founding Fathers, although they are Founding Fathers in the sense that they founded Plymouth.
So the people who came over on that Mayflower, what, about 100 and some odd people, Rebecca? How many?
It's 102, but 50% die. So
yes.
In the terrible winter.
Well, and we'll definitely talk about that. So the people who got on that boat, they are pilgrims. They are the ones making this pilgrimage, basically, to a new world. And most of them happen to be Puritans, right? Which was a form of Protestantism. So what did they believe and how was that different than the way Christianity was being practiced in England at the time?
Well, these Puritans who are separatists want to set up a separate church separate to the existing Church of England in England created by Henry VIII because they are disappointed by the Elizabethan Reformation. They think it doesn't go far enough. They think that it's clear from sort of examination of ancient texts, which is going on by Reformation scholars, that there were obviously no bishops in the ancient Church of Christ. And they take that very seriously, as did many Puritans, including the Puritans who come to Massachusetts. But they take it particularly seriously, and they want to create their own little church, which is separate to the Church of England, which at that point is completely illegal. And they have secret gatherings in Nottinghamshire. And eventually, because James I becomes much more severe about nonconformism than Elizabeth was, they have to flee. And that's why they flee to Holland, which, because they're in the middle of a war with Spain, with the Catholic Spanish Empire, welcome any Protestants, basically. It's a sort of super Protestant culture. And they want to separate from the Church of England, whereas the Puritans who come to and found Massachusetts and found Boston 10 years later are non-separating Congregationalists. They remain, in theory, part of the Church of England.
Which is interesting. Yeah.
Yes.
So just remind us, and it's, you know, it's an important point that you make, that James comes in, James the First, I think.
Yes. And
he says, you can't worship differently than what I say. And, you know, today we find that shocking. But just remind us, Rebecca, I mean, the crown basically dictated how people worship God.
Absolutely, because of the Reformation was begun by Henry VIII, and he was sort of he was sort of more lukewarm about Puritans. Some people say that a lot of the Church of England remained pretty similar to the Catholic Church. Elizabeth is more sort of a reformer, so is her brother, but basically. It's a sort of, as James I realised, if you have a very democratic system in which it's the elders who decide how to elect the minister, who the minister should be, in the end, the role of the monarch is redundant. And James I pithily said, no bishop, no king. That was his position. And he clamps down on what we call nonconformism, i.e. very sort of extreme Puritanism or Puritanism.
You need to do it the way I say, or you will be imprisoned or killed.
Yeah.
So the Puritans go to Holland. And as you described, it's this sort of uber Protestant society. And at first they say, this is great, you know, but after a while, it gets kind of difficult for them in Holland. So just describe how they were treated there, Rebecca. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't great.
Yes. I mean, there was something called the sort of Dutch economic miracle going on, partly because a lot of Protestant refugees were fleeing out of Catholic provinces in Holland, chased by the Spanish. And a lot of them were great innovators in weaving and the clothing manufacturing industry. And what they needed, frankly, was sort of immigrant labour. And of course, these people coming from England need to be employed. And like many refugees, they are having to take not well-paid jobs, and they're working 12-hour days. And William Bradford says, we saw our children get old before our eyes.
Wow.
And they realise that that's really why they need to get out of Holland. And in the end, America is the solution. And also, America is a very exciting concept at that time, because the Dutch have just started exploring in the New York area.
So in Holland, you know, they say welcome and, you know, enjoy your Protestantism and do what you want with it. But you are immigrants. You're not really from here. So we'll give you work, but it's going to be pretty grueling. And after a while, they just say, OK, enough. In addition to the Puritans, there was another group on the Mayflower, and we should talk about them too, Rebecca. We tend to forget about them. There's so much focus on pilgrims and Puritans. The adventurers, now who are they?
Well, they are what were thought to be going to be the practical men, or the practical young men who were going to help cut down the trees, build the houses, raise the house frames, and also make barrels. There was a cooper who is the famous John Alden, in fact. Nowadays, scholars think that actually there was probably less difference between the adventurers and the pilgrims themselves, that probably the adventurers had some links to separatist churches. In fact, the father of Priscilla Mullins, the famous Priscilla, was someone who turns out to have been had up for belonging to some kind of illegal church in London. So they're a sort of mixed bag. I mean, they are more mercantile. They are also belonging to more practical trades. And that's why John Robinson says we've got to have the famous Mayflower Compact, which is going to encompass all these different people and make them cooperate.
So these were the young men who were supposedly strong and skilled, and they were going to do all the hard work building the houses and so forth. And yet, you know, when you think about having this supposedly practical-minded group on board with the Pilgrims, it's pretty amazing to look at the preparations, or we should say, Rebecca, lack thereof, for this voyage. I mean, one review of your book wrote that the average camping trip is better planned than the Mayflower voyage. I mean, the example this writer gave, they brought a full suit of armor, a fancy cradle, and no fishing rods. Okay, so you're going to be out in the Atlantic Ocean for 2 months with no fishing rods. Who planned this thing, and why did they do it so badly?
Well, because basically what had happened is William Brewster, who Edward Winslow worked for, was a grand man in England, but he really starts the church in Scrooby. But he's lost everything because of his religion, and he works as a publisher. He has something called the Brewster Press, which has become very famous with the sort of a bear on it, Bruin. And Edward Winslow works for him anyway. They print Puritan literature, illegal Puritan literature, which they send to England, and they sometimes send it in wine casks.
Send it from Holland to England.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And although it was illegal, people turned a blind eye to it. But just as they're negotiating to get out of England, William Brewster is so outraged by James I trying to reintroduce bishops into the Church of Scotland that he publishes this pamphlet by a Scot protesting about this. And this is an attack on royal policy. So suddenly everything changes. Brewster has to go on the run. And what had been sort of an expedition to make a colony, which had been viewed with sympathetic eyes by the Virginia company, becomes much more hole in corner. They have to be really smuggled out. Brewster goes on the run, and everything, it's done sort of secretly. So they don't really have time to do anything. Then they have to sit around in at Southampton waiting for Brewster to reappear. And they start using up all their supplies. The people at Southampton start demanding harbour dues, which they hadn't expected. So they're sort of running out, and they're terrified that they're about to be arrested. So there isn't really room to sort of really plan in the way that the Winthrop fleet was able to plan.
Now, that's interesting. So just tying together a few threads there. So Brewster creates a ruckus with this publication. He goes into hiding. So they can't really work openly on this project and seek financing and seek support and seek expertise.
Exactly. They do because, but it's much more, it's sort of below the radar. Whereas before, to some extent, they were getting backing. They were getting backing from government ministers in England.
Okay, so when you mentioned Southampton, so that is where, that's the point in England, right, Rebecca, where they took off. And, you know, and we're going to get to the New World in just a minute, but it is so interesting in your book. You know, you're kind of tearing your hair out reading it. You're going, come on, people. Because it was so hard for them to get away, and you understand why, but they just keep trying and something bad happens, and they keep trying and something bad happens, and you know, you sense their frustration. So they go to Holland, as you describe, they go back to England, Southampton, they're planning for this voyage. They get on a boat called the Speedwell, not the Mayflower.
There's two boats.
The Speedwell and the Mayflower. Okay.
Yeah.
And what happens then?
Basically, as I say, they no longer have the sort of backing they were hoping they were going to have, in that Brewster was quite connected to the Virginia Company, which was a really grand company which settled Virginia. So they're now dependent on an iron merchant named Weston, who's also sort of connected to the City of London, but at a much lower level. So they rent two not great boats. One is the Speedwell, which springs a leak 100 leagues past Land's End, and they all have to turn back again. And then that some people decant to the Mayflower, and some people, like Robert Cushman, sort of, you know, they all get too nervous to carry on.
They just say, forget it, this is a bad omen.
Forget, yeah. Exactly. And so on goes the Mayflower alone. But it was just a wine ship. It was not ocean going. It had been going back and forwards between Bordeaux and sort of English Channel ports. So it was a leaky old ship. It was small. It was tiny.
It is amazing to think about it. And I had not known until I read your book, you know, I knew the Mayflower was small, but the fact that they took this ship that was used to going back and forth between England and France, which let's just say is a short trip, carrying wine, not people, and they took this thing across the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, it kind of staggers the imagination, Rebecca.
Absolutely. But, you know, I think religious faith and sort of determination and excitement. I mean, the New World was tremendously excitement. It was the subject of all the sort of growth in the publishing industry is travel literature. And it's sort of writing about Native Americans. I mean, they are a subject of tremendous fascination for England.
Well, I want to remind our listeners that they can join us. The number here in the exchange for your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, it's a new take on a familiar tale. We're talking with the author of a new book called The Mayflower, The Families, The Voyage, and the Founding of America. Again, the number for your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. So, Rebecca, phew, they make it to New England after all these crazy things that happen. Why did they choose Plymouth? Why not somewhere else?
Well, what happens is they land at what's now Provincetown, and then they think, you know, this is not going to be good farming. So then one of the people on the ship has actually been to New England, and he says across the bay there is something, there's sort of better land, it's sort of more spread out. But they go up and down Cape Cod looking really for somewhere to settle. And then after a sort of 3-day journey, which involves Edward Winslow and other leaders, they finally hit Plymouth. But of course, Patuxet, as it was known to the Native Americans, had been visited many times before. And in fact, one of the Native Americans who's going to play such a hugely important part in this story had been carried off from there. And his name was Tisquantum, or Squanto, as he's now known.
Yeah, and pretty famous. And we'll definitely talk about that. We often hear how terrible that first year was, partly because, Rebecca, they arrived so late. Why did they make such a bad decision about when to leave England? Because by the time they get to New England, it's pretty darn cold.
Absolutely. But don't forget, they've been delayed by Brewster being hunted up and down England. So they're hanging around in Southampton waiting for him. And that's really the problem. And then they're going back out, and then the Speedwell's springing a leak. So everything is delayed. Although, in fact, it was colonizers' law that it was better to go in the autumn, because there wouldn't be the bugs that there would be if you arrived in summer. This was a terrible time to arrive because you would get fever. Of course, they didn't know they were going to get to New England, and a cold New England winter. I mean, you know, a New Hampshire sort of winter.
Yeah, I'm always surprised by that. But they knew they were coming to New England, though. They knew they weren't going to Virginia, right? So wouldn't they have known that there's a big temperature difference?
They didn't really know where they were going. I mean, they were going somewhere in Virginia, but it's all very vague because they had to be very vague. They were on their way to Virginia, then they're turned back because the storms were really getting too bad.
I see. Okay. So that's why they thought, sure, arrive in fall. That's great. Whereas anybody in New England will tell you, no, it really gets cold here. So you maybe don't want to start a brand new colony October, November. We will talk more after a short break, and we will dig into the amazing Edward Winslow. One writer called him one of the most important and yet least remembered leaders, that without him, Plymouth might not have survived. We'll talk about that and how it was really Winslow's deep friendships with the Native Americans, his deep respect for them, that kept these people alive. We'll cover all that after a short break. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the familiar coming-to-America tale of the Mayflower, but told in a new way through the story of Plymouth colonist Edward Winslow, once called the Hercules of the colony. Our guest is historian Rebecca Fraser. Her new book is called The Mayflower, The Families, The Voyage, and the Founding of America. The number for you to join us with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, Rebecca, let's talk about Edward Winslow. Again, now people are calling him one of the most important and yet least remembered leaders. Really, he's the guy we can thank for helping to save this colony. Who was he?
Well, he was the son of a merchant from Worcestershire. I mean, it was sort of a similar sort of dynamic family that produced Shakespeare. And he was very cultured. He'd gone to a very good school. He read Latin and Greek, and that's how he could become a printer. And he was a publisher. He was a publisher and printer. And he was fascinated by the Native Americans. And I think this stemmed from the fact that when he's in London, before he goes to Leiden, Pocahontas.
Leiden again is Holland.
Holland.
Where they had to hide out. Yeah.
Yeah. He's in London when Pocahontas visits James I and is treated as the daughter of an emperor, which she was. And James I has a mask for her and a dance, and Ben Jonson writes poetry about her. So this is an incredibly exciting moment. And I think people don't really remember that. The discovery of the New World was like the internet today. It just changed everything. And so everything in the New World was a source of tremendous fascination. Had the Native Americans survived Noah's flood? What were they doing then? Were they the lost tribes of Israel? There were so many theories about them. And I think Edward, because he was a publisher, was fascinated by literature, and he wanted to reach out and get to know the Wampanoags, who, of course, were also going to be key to their survival and key to fur, which was also the fur trade, which was also going to help them survive.
Right. So he is, as you say, very open-minded, very curious. And unlike, you know, modern depictions or what happened later, early on, Edward Winslow, you know, he's not racist. He doesn't think the Indians are beneath him. He's fascinated by them. He has deep, deep friendships, deep, deep respect for the Native Americans. And that kind of helps the pilgrims make it, right? I mean, because he's respectful to them, the natives say, sure, we'll help you out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also to Massasoit, the king of the Wampanoags, huge advantage to have these English settlers who have better technology than him on his side, because his people have been terribly depleted by this plague, which arrives just before the pilgrims arrive. And as a result, having been overlord of the area, he's now really at the mercy of the Narragansett tribe. And so it's to his advantage to be friendly with Plymouth, and it's to Plymouth's advantage to be friendly with them. But they are this is a very symbiotic relationship. And Edward actually saves Massasoit's life. But all the colony, I would say, are reaching out to the Native Americans and vice versa. So it's a very attractive thing.
Early on.
And in fact,
ahead.
And in fact, John Winthrop, in his journal in 1634, 4 years after he arrives in Boston, notes this incredible friendship, jokey friendship between Massasoit, who he calls Edward Winslow's old ally. So he sort of describes how Edward is given a lift from where Massasoit lives near Rhode Island back to Plymouth in his canoe.
Well, so, and, you know, next week, Thanksgiving, we will all see those pictures of, you know, natives and pilgrims celebrating together on that supposed first Thanksgiving. But just remind us, it is really worth remembering how much the natives did save the pilgrims from starving. And why did they do it?
Well, I think they were benevolent. I mean, I think they're sort of kindly. These people arrive. They're very helpless. There is a description by Thomas Morton, who, of course, was the sort of frenemy of Plymouth, living round the corner, that the Native Americans were very surprised at the way the pilgrims didn't put headstones for their dead, and they were sort of dying at the rate of knots in the winter of 1620. And I think, you know, they think they're a bit sort of pathetic. I mean, they are really at the mercy of the elements.
They're starving. And they're freezing and they're starving.
Yeah, go ahead. And they have not brought corn. They have to borrow corn from a Native American grave. So as you say, it is extraordinary, the lack of preparation.
The lack of preparation and the generosity of the natives. So
Absolutely. There's
been more recent scholarship, and you talk about this a lot in your book, about Native Americans. How has this more up-to-date research and scholarship about the natives, how has that changed the view of the choices that they made in interacting with the colonists? Because you mention often in the book, Rebecca, that now that we know more about Native history and Native politics, our understanding has changed, and your book sheds light on that.
Yeah, I was very fascinated. I mean, obviously, the development of what's called ethnohistory in the past 30 years has brought the relationship between the Native Americans and the colonists into much tighter focus. And I think that in the past, brilliant historians like Francis Jennings did see sort of aspects of the interaction as genocidal on the part of the settlers. But I think today's historians and academics see it as a much more shaded, much more nuanced field. There was much more cooperation and there were much better relationships. And each side really was anxious to learn from the other.
Tell us a little bit more, Rebecca.
At the beginning.
Yeah, at the beginning. And again, everybody knows how it devolves and we'll talk about that. But just you described Edward Winslow, how he approached this, his mindset, his background. Give us a little bit more on the other major character in this drama, Massasoit, the chief of the Wampanoags.
Well, we have this wonderful description of him that he is wearing what Edward thinks is a sort of white bone necklace, but actually what it is wampum, and these shells are going to become the currency of New England because there was so little specie. There was a barter system, or in the end, they adopted what the Native Americans used, which had, of course, had a sacred meaning, but became purely financial for the English, which was to use wampum as a currency. And he's very adorned with this currency and is very wealthy. And he's a wonderful, mellow character. And there are lots of descriptions, not just the December 1621, supposed first Thanksgiving description, but there are lots of letters describing Massasoit dancing, for example, at the second wedding of Governor William Bradford with his sort of other chiefs. And it's a very joyous, joyous relationship. And I would say that Massasoit is a sort of a mellow fellow. You know, he's fun, he's charismatic, and he's a great leader. And he says to all his sort of subsidiary tribes, you have to make peace with these people. So he is behind their being able to access the fur trade and having peace really for a long time.
Well, and Edward Winslow does give us that description of the first Thanksgiving, even though at the time, obviously, it wasn't called Thanksgiving. And I want to play just a little bit, Rebecca, a paragraph from a letter that Edward Winslow wrote to a friend back in England. He wrote it in December of 1621. And here he describes the feast that the pilgrims and the natives celebrated together that fall.
Our harvest being gotten in, our governor sent 4 men on fowling, so that we might, after a special manner, rejoice together, after we had gathered the fruits of our labors. They 4, in one day, killed as much fowl as, with a little help beside, served the company almost a week, at which time, amongst other recreations, we exercised our arms. And many of the Indians coming amongst us, and amongst the rest their greatest king, Massasoit, with some 90 men, whom for 3 days we entertained and feasted. And they went out and killed 5 deer, which they brought to the plantation and bestowed on our governor, and upon the captain and others.
That Edward Winslow letter read by Andrew Perella here at NHPR. And, you know, Rebecca, you hear in that letter, you hear joy, you hear plenty. And there's a part in the book where you say, for a brief period, It really was kind of like Eden, you know? There were plenty of fish, there were plenty of berries, you could grow stuff, you could hunt deer wherever you wanted. The natives and the pilgrims were getting along. I mean, everything was great for a little while.
Yes, I think Plymouth was a very small colony. It always was very small. The Pilgrim Fathers, they were very reliant, but also very curious about Native American culture. And Edward sends this long report back to the City of London investors, sort of describing the wonderful culture he's encountering. And there's lists of vocabulary, what the Native Americans believed in, where their heaven was, how they memorialized things. And he was absolutely fascinated by their culture, as, of course, were many English writers such as John Smith and William Strachey. But this is sort of before Roger Williams writes his sort of incredible book, The Key to America. And this is a description of a civilization that they, are the colonists, are embracing.
So people like Edward Winslow and others are writing how, you know, how the natives are incredible, how the food, there's abundance, and people notice that the air is sharp and clean, you know, unlike England. So then other people start coming over wanting a piece of this, saying, this sounds great, things aren't going so well here in England, let's go to the New World. What happens, Rebecca, when more people start coming over beyond these early colonists at Plymouth?
Well, it just does change the dynamic in that from 1630, when Boston is founded, the Massachusetts Bay Company creates a colony, to 1640, when immigration sort of dries up because the civil wars are beginning to begin in England. You get 20,000 people coming into New England.
Wow, that's a lot.
It's a lot. And meanwhile, at the same time, the plague, which had not really hit the inland tribes, reaches the Narragansetts in about 1633. So you get all sorts of tensions and people become very trigger happy, and people arriving at Boston are much more, they don't really know, they don't really understand sort of how Native American affairs run in the way that Plymouth does, and things start to degenerate. And it is overwhelming. It's sort of numbers. It's a numbers problem, people wanting land, even though America is so enormous.
Still is. So 1620, the pilgrims come over on the Mayflower. They understand the natives. They have good friendships with them. But when all these people start coming over by 1630, founding of Boston, there's not these relationships. People don't make the effort, and maybe there's too many people to have close friendships with the natives, and so things start to unravel. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm just saying that there's a sort of difference. The weather changes, if you like, in that Plymouth has had all this time to develop sort of a political relationship, and Boston is also being racked by tremendous religious conflict. The Anne Hutchinson affair makes everyone think, oh, this sort of holy colony, is it cursed? Is Satan in the wilderness with us? So there's all kinds of anxieties which start in Boston in a very short space when the colony's only just begun. I mean, it's a very fragile colony. It's only been there for sort of 5 or 6 years when Anne Hutchinson starts to criticise the ministers. And I think there's a kind of, this means they don't have the time to sort of, to think about Native Americans. Though at first, you know, John Winthrop invites all these chiefs into his house. I mean, it's an anxious time. And then there's a sort of knock-on effect of malcontents from Boston moving to settle Connecticut. And that's moving into the Connecticut Valley. And that sort of starts to displace Native Americans there, who are already in a sort of tense state because of this terrible plague which has come in 1633.
I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your comments and questions. The author is Rebecca Fraser. The book is called The Mayflower, The Families, The Voyage, and The Founding of America. And we're digging into some of the fascinating details about those very early days in the 1620s and 30s. You can join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhp.org. nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So a couple interesting things you said there, Rebecca. And one of them is this English Civil War and how that caused people to want to leave. Just very quickly remind us what the English Civil War was at that time.
It's the Puritans in Parliament. Parliament's been closed down by Charles I because of their demands. And finally, he has to recall Parliament, which had been in abeyance for 11 years. It's known as the 11 Years' Tyranny. And it then becomes a sort of battle between Parliament and the King. And a lot of the parliamentarians are Puritans with relations in New England. And one quarter of New Englanders go back to fight in the Civil War on the side of Parliament against the King. They either go back during the war or just after, because America has been perceived as this new godly land in which there are going to be no bishops. There's going to be a sort of a new, better form of religion, which isn't going to be corrupt like the old Church of England. But once the Civil War starts and bishops are actually abolished by Parliament, people start thinking, is the promised land going to be England maybe? And it was, no one, I think, from Plymouth returned. But there were a lot of connections between Boston and London. And so that there is sort of, where is the promised land going to be? So this, and also immigration comes to a stop because everyone's having to decide in England whose side they are on. And that has economic knock-on effects because immigrants all brought money, or they certainly brought goods, they brought labour, and that all sort of stops. And so New England's economy has a problem really once immigration stops in around 1640, just as the Civil War is about to break out.
Yeah, and I'm surprised that Puritans were even allowed in Parliament, that it got to that point, because what happened to the Pilgrims, 15, 20 years earlier, they had to be in hiding, so...
But they were separatists, whereas these people are Puritans who remain part of the Church of England. They're critical, but they're not saying we're breaking away. They're saying, okay, the King can remain head of our church.
Sure, and then Charles I is, he's beheaded, right? I mean, ultimately, it does not end well for him, this English Civil War, if we could put it that way. And until I read this book, Rebecca, I didn't realize that so many New Englanders at that time were still so deeply connected to England and said, yes, we're going to go back and fight.
Yes, I mean, I've obviously, as an English person, I found that particularly interesting because, in a way, if you're English, you wonder, do people who go to the New World, do they come back?
Right.
Do they have a relationship? Do their cousins sort of get letters from them? And it was much more interconnected. And, of course, the English colonists called the Native Americans just Americans. I mean, although Edward Winslow himself says things like, as early as 1637, New England is growing up into a nation.
Well, and in fact, that is very interesting as well. Yes, he does early on, more than a century before the American Revolution, he says this needs to be a separate place. So we will pick up on that and many more points after a short break. You can join us as well. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. A lot more in a moment.
To know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our guest is British historian and author Rebecca Fraser with her new book called The Mayflower, The Families, The Voyage, and the founding of America. The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Rebecca, just picking up on something else that you said earlier, you were talking about how when people started coming over in large numbers, founding the city of Boston, didn't have the close relationships that the Plymouth colonists had with the natives. Things start to go bad. And you say partly it was an anxious time because of something you called the Anne Hutchinson Affair. Now, this is an important part of the book, so just remind us who Anne Hutchinson was and how she stirred up a hornet's nest.
Well, like many Puritan ladies, she was very highly educated, and she had very strong views about religion, and she was a friend of John Cotton, and she had strong theories about grace, covenant of grace versus the covenant of works, and she really believed that if the Spirit came to you and you felt you were one of the elect, that was so. You didn't need to sort of prove it. Now this sort of challenged the male hierarchy in Boston, and she was a midwife, and she was a brilliant woman, but she was also really a prophetess. And people, after all these people have come to create a better, godlier, a sort of better land, and suddenly a sort of consensus is being challenged by a woman who doesn't, she may have read widely, but she is not a scholar. She is not part of the establishment. So this it was perceived as anarchic. But she also had a great many followers, including the new governor who had come out from England, Henry Vane the Younger, thought she was terrific. So there begins to be terrible divisions in this young, fragile colony. And inevitably, this is a time when God and the devil are very manifest, and some people think that this is a sign that Satan is in the wilderness, that she's going to destroy the colony. And so there's a tension, which is already a lot of tension. After all, this is a brand new land. Everyone's feeling their way. Even the government is fairly fragile, and she's a challenge to that. So there's sort of anxiety. Could the Native Americans, who after all are not Christian, could they be part of this, the satanic side of the wilderness? And there are all these theories floating around, and they're affected by, some people are affected by the 30 Years' War, which has been going on. Some people have fought that in Holland versus Spain. And so I think there's great anxiety. So no one reacts particularly well to anything.
Well, there's anxiety, yes, about the events in Europe. Anxiety because relationships with the natives are breaking down. You're never sure who's a friendly tribe and who isn't. And the Native Americans, some of the tribes, sort of exploit that anxiety. There's one native leader. Oh, I need to remember his name. I think it was Usars or something. A couple of them sort of tell the pilgrim. Yes, Uncas, thank you. He tells the colonists in Boston, you know, this tribe is going to attack you tomorrow and that tribe is going to attack you next week. So they kind of foment the anxiety for their own gain. Not all the tribes, but some of them.
Yes. And I think the development of sort of academic study of ethnohistory means that people are now very aware of the sort of what's going on, the sort of intertribal relations. And so Uncas is part of a very minor tribe, and he is really trying to get power from the Narragansetts, who are sort of majorly important tribe. And so he has the ear of Boston, and he starts whispering poison into it. And as a result, in the end, although Plymouth is very unconvinced, it all sort of starts to spiral out of control. And Miantonimo, who's the sort of great hope of the Narragansetts, who've been kings of the area for thousands of years, is sort of caused, you know, Boston sort of, as it were, like Pontius Pilate, they wash their hands, and Uncas executes Miantonimo. And that sets up a terrible sort of tsunami of distrust and hostility. Whereas in the past, there really had been a loving friendship. And so that happens in 1643. And then things begin to gather momentum. And although while Massasoit is still alive, he vanishes from the records in about 1660. And while the old leaders, the people who've been on the Mayflower, are still alive, there is still a good relationship, I would say, by and large. I think the peace does hold in Plymouth for 40 years. Outside Plymouth, things are beginning to sort of gather, and Plymouth can't help but be affected by the fact that the younger Wampanoags are very affected by the execution of the leader of this very important tribe, Miantonome.
Yeah, and until I read this book, you know, I didn't appreciate the different experience that Plymouth had versus Boston. You know, these days we kind of lump it all together, yeah, but it's a very different relationship with Native Americans and a lot of infighting among the people in Boston, as you describe, with this Anne Hutchinson affair. And just to put a fine point on that, she ultimately goes to Rhode Island, right, in search of religious freedom? Yeah, go ahead.
And of course, she is given land by Massasoit and the Narragansetts. And of course, this also, because she's now regarded as a dangerous heretic, this is another reason to sort of ratchet up the tensions between the two peoples.
When and why did the English colonists begin trying to convert the natives to Christianity? Because from your book, Rebecca, you write that that was not initially a goal, at least for Edward Winslow at Plymouth. He admired the natives' spirituality and spiritual practices. So when did that sort of shift? Let's try to convert them.
Well, it's very interesting. You're absolutely right. It doesn't really start till 1646, so it's very late. And it starts under John Eliot in Boston. And it is really as a result of the death of Miantonome. There is this sort of Cold War, this beginning of hostility. And having really left religion alone, there's a feeling that sort of perhaps in order to break the hostility, if we could sort of preach our culture to Native Americans, perhaps, you know, it was in some ways it was very a benevolent idea. Edward Winslow, in fact, in the early days of Plymouth, as we know, has enjoyed discussing things, religious affairs, with Corbetton of the Pocassets. But as Professor Neil Salisbury has said, he is alone in that, by and large, Plymouth did leave the Native Americans alone. There was no attempt to convert them, although they were encouraged to come into their meeting house. And in fact, that's where Roger Williams actually first encounters the Narragansetts, who give him land when he's forced out of Boston as being another heretic.
So it was the Boston colonists who originally thought, look, there's a lot of tension with these Native Americans. We're never sure which tribe is going to attack us. So let's try to Christianize them?
Yes. I mean, I think it's often portrayed as a bad thing. But in fact, part of this was establishing an Indian college at Harvard. And the idea was to bring enlightenment, sweetness and light, education to the Native Americans. So it wasn't to wipe out their culture, although Philip, the son of Massasoit, begins to perceive it as something which is going to eradicate a culture, a unique culture. John Eliot was really a wonderful, extraordinary person, and he's known as the apostle to the Indians, in the past. And he wants to help with education. But what happens is you start to get these praying towns, which is sort of towns with European or English-style houses with Native Americans living there in English-style clothes, their hair cut short. And although it's voluntary, the question is, how voluntary was it? Because, in fact, there are letters, Roger Williams reports to England that chiefs that he knows, Narragansetts, are saying, please put an end to these praying towns. This is not our culture.
Yeah.
And that's about 1654.
Well, and it's easy to understand why Philip would feel like it was going to wipe out a unique culture. Because, as you said, Rebecca, in these praying towns, the natives basically, you know, lived as Englishmen and women. And that must have been very upsetting for Native Americans, for some Native Americans.
I think the other thing to remember is that Philip also wants to learn from these new people. So he actually asks John Eliot to send him someone to teach his peoples, to educate them. And that's someone called John Sassaman, who actually was educated at the Indian College at Harvard. And so he is interested in progress, but he doesn't want it to wipe out his particular power. So there's a sort of a power struggle going on, but it's not that Philip is against embracing European or English culture, but it has to be on his terms.
Why is he called Philip, by the way? He's the son of Massasoit, right?
Yes. His real name is Metacom, and his brother was called Wamsutta. And Massasoit asked Plymouth to give his sons English names, and this seems to have been confirmed by the sons. So they are known to Plymouth as Alexander, and Metacom becomes known as Philip. And of course, this terrible war which starts is known as King Philip's War. But obviously amongst, what name did he himself use? I think he used, there are documents in which he signs himself Philip, or is a document in which the name Philip is put. But was he known as Wamsutta amongst his people? I mean, in fact, Native Americans had many names, so that Massasoit had another name, which was Osumikin. So
King Philip's War, and we've heard of it, and you're sort of leading up to it, Rebecca. So let's go there. You said that Philip was, obviously, he learned from his father to like and trust these English people. We have a very close, warm relationship between Edward Winslow and Massasoit. You said a moment ago Philip was interested in learning from the English. What's the tipping point for Philip? When does he say enough is enough?
Well, I think there comes a problem, which is that Massasoit, maybe because he is feeling that the English have become less friendly after the Pickett War, does start to sell a lot more land than the younger leaders to the English than the younger leaders, which is Wamsutta and Metacom, would like. And the land sales really become really sort of staggering amounts starts to be sold, so that the English, Plymouth, starts to sort of lap up against Mount Hope, which is the ancestral lands of the Wampanoags. And I think Philip becomes very alarmed by this. And I think the fact is the execution of Miantonimo in 1643 people can't believe that a royal person was killed by this sort of new tribe in the country, which is the English. And this is, it's a real insult. And I think it's very hard to get over. And I think Philip is a much more fiery character. And there's been this additional thing, which is that his brother has died, unfortunately, after a visit to Josiah Winslow's house. And the question is, I mean, clearly Josiah Winslow had nothing to do with him dying. I mean, there was some sort of illness. But all the contemporary accounts of the war, whether by William Hubbard or Increase Mather, all say that Philip had a particular animus against Edward Winslow's son, probably because he perceived Plymouth as becoming much more authoritarian. And it's true that Plymouth and Josiah become fed up because there are sort of rumours of war dances going on in Mount Hope, and rumours that the American Indian tribes in other parts of the country are all getting together, and that a war might come sooner rather than later. I mean, it's always been a sort of anxiety. Will these tribes sort of gang
join
up
forces
together?
Yeah. Well, so Josiah Winslow, Edward Winslow's son, gets a visit or invites King Philip's brother to his house, and the brother dies shortly thereafter. So King Philip must have thought he got poisoned or something at Josiah Winslow's house, right?
In fact, what happens is that Plymouth becomes more sort of autocratic in its dealings with Philip, the Wampanoags, and Philip is asked to come to court, and he doesn't. In fact, Josiah goes and brings him in and sort of says, you're meant to be in court. We asked you to do this. Clearly, there is some problem with Wamsutta, with Alexander, and he does die. But Philip perceives it being Josiah's fault. And I think his sort of mood is getting more and more sort of ominous. And he also thinks that if he doesn't revolt against the English colonists who are starting to demand he obeys their laws, which they never had before, by the sort of late 60s, early 70s, if he doesn't revolt now, it's now or never.
So tons of anxiety. It's almost hard to appreciate the anxiety on both sides. The colonists are hearing rumors that the tribes are all going to band together and, you know, start a war against them. Meanwhile, there's all this infighting among Native Americans and these attacks and these demands, and they're losing their lands from the growing English population. So it's, you know, it's hard to imagine how thick the anxiety and tension must have been at that time, Rebecca.
Yes, I think it's very difficult for us to understand. And I think people who see the sort of, you know, there is a sort of a school of historians who see the English as very sort of genocidal. I really think that's not true. I think that the fact is tensions were rising for lots of different reasons. And the English population, although large, were farmers. They were not soldiers, whereas the American Indians, you know, they were honed in battle. That was something they did for fun. So I think there was real anxiety that they could all be very threatened, that one day maybe the Native Americans could turn on them.
What's the overall message that you hope readers get from this book, Rebecca? There's a lot in here, but what's the sort of one thing you hope readers walk away with?
Well, I think that actually the beginnings of Plymouth Colony is incredibly moving and wonderful. And I think King Philip's War is just a blip.
Well, Rebecca, we could talk for hours because there's a lot in here. I really appreciate you being with us this hour. Thank you so much. And a happy early Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you.
That's Rebecca Fraser. Again, she's a British historian, author of the book we talked about, Mayflower, The Families, The Voyage, and The Founding of America. So if you are into this topic, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. We've got a portrait of Edward Winslow, other really lovely paintings of the Mayflower, and that Edward Winslow letter about the first Thanksgiving on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.